Our topic this morning is a topic of making sense of your adolescent's behavior. It's number 8 in our series on parenting teens, and really the mark of a whole new emphasis in our course. Up till now, we've been talking a whole lot about the insides, what needs to happen internally for a parent to be able to be that effective leader, that effective discipler of their own kids. Now we're going to be talking a whole lot more about skills that the mature parent will be able to use in a pretty natural kind of way. And let me just warn you that some of these skills are going to seem difficult, especially for those that are, let's say they haven't locked into some of the concepts we've talked about so far in this course. Concepts like distancing, concepts like reflecting as parents, because all of these skills will require some use, some practice of all those principles that have come up to this point. But let me encourage you also, parents, because we really expect that these skills are going to be hard and a little awkward for any parent to just start using right off the bat. And they do require a great deal of maturity, and that's part of the reason why we have a whole ministry to parents of teens here at the chapel, a ministry that works not only on maturity and not just on skills, but on both, putting the two together and building wise parents who have some idea of how to intervene in their kids' lives in an effective kind of way. Now let's turn together and begin in our notes with the biblical foundation for this particular lesson, and turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 3. Just want to look very briefly at a verse of scripture here in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. And the context of this is it's a command to husbands to live with their wives in a certain kind of way. 1 Peter 3, 7. Peter says, after he has just finished addressing the wives, he says, husbands, you in the same way, in the same kind of way where you're not controlled by fear. He just finished telling the wives that they'll be daughters of Sarah if they do what is right and do not give way to fear. And so Peter says, then you husbands too, don't be characterized or controlled by fear, but in the same way, you live with your wives in a considerate or understanding way, treating them with respect as a weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your own prayer life, your own dependent relationship with the Lord. Husbands, live with your wives in an understanding kind of way. Now, next week we'll be talking more about this idea of respect and friendship. But today we want to talk about how do you live with your not only your wives, but more importantly, your children. And children that are starting to become a lot like adults, adolescent children. How do you live with them in an understanding kind of way? I think Peter would give parents of teens that same command to live with them in an understanding way. Now, that requires several essential skills. And let's look at some of those skills back in Proverbs chapter 18. Proverbs chapter 18 gives us a number of skills. We want to look at five in particular this morning. Five particular skills that are essential if you're going to live with your adolescent in a way that's going to make sense of his behavior. And it's a way that's going to be built on understanding. Now, notice chapter 18 as we begin. Verses 1 and 2. It says here, an unfriendly man pursues selfish ends. He defies all sound judgment. A fool finds no pleasure in understanding. That's not what he's after. But he's delights in airing his own opinions. He delights in giving advice. It's not based on understanding at all. An unfriendly man pursues selfish ends. Now that's our first skill we're going to be looking at in more depth a little bit later today. But let me mention that skill. It's the skill of discerning your own goals as a parent. Discerning your own goals as a parent. Having some understanding of what it is that controls you or guides you as you begin to open your mouth and talk with your teen. Or as you begin to respond and intervene perhaps in his life. What goal controls you? It's interesting here. He says it's the person who is pursuing selfish ends that is perceived as unfriendly. Perceived as unfriendly. And of course we know that as soon as someone approaches you that you perceive as unfriendly, what do you want to do? You want to close them off. You want to put down close the doors and shut the gates and keep them from coming in, and that gets in the way of understanding. He goes on and says, It's the fool, the one that's pursuing his own selfish ends, that finds no pleasure at all in understanding others. In fact, all he's concerned about is people understanding him, people understanding his viewpoint. And he's quick then to give advice and to speak. Unless a parent has some awareness and control of his own or her own goals, it's going to be virtually impossible for him to be able to come to a good understanding of why his adolescent is acting, thinking, moving the direction he is. It says here that an unfriendly man who pursues selfish ends defies or misses all sound judgment. He's not able to really understand. So we're going to see the first characteristic or quality is discerning your own goals as a parent. Now, skill number two that we read here is found in verse 4. And it goes like this: the words of a man's mouth are deep waters, but the fountain of wisdom is a bubbling brook. Verse 6 goes on and talks a little bit more about the words of a man's mouth and how they're deep waters. And it says in verse 6, a fool's lips bring him strife, and his mouth invites a beating. It goes on in verse 7 and says even more, a fool's mouth is his own undoing, and his lips are a snare to his soul. The words of a gossip in verse 8 are like choice morsels. They go down to a man's inmost parts. Now, the second skill we want to talk about is this skill of being able to listen beneath your children's words. It says words are deep waters. Words take you down and snare a person's souls. If you listen long enough, a person will snare their own soul. They'll in a sense betray their own inner purposes and beliefs if you listen long enough. Listening underneath words for hidden meanings, listening underneath words for messages that are implied, listening underneath words in a way to snag what their inner purposes are and where their souls are moving, says that it's possible, by listening to a person's words, to know where to give them a beating. A fool's own lips or words invites a beating and shows you where to move. How do you apply the scalpel to your child's cancers? Where do you intervene? How do you make an application in their life? And in a real way, their words will give you that understanding. And so listening underneath words is a real key skill. Now, if you look at verse 13, we even see one other verse about listening. It says, he who answers before listening, that's going to be his own folly and his shame. It's funny, but we remember as we talked a few weeks ago, we talked about what happens when parents operate by automatic responses. Well, it says here that if you automatically respond to your kid without listening, that's going to be your own folly and your shame. You're going to most always end up reinforcing foolishness and bringing about a shameful kind of result in your kid's life rather than the true understanding that will promote authentic godliness. Now, there's a third skill we want to mention here, and that skill is found in verses 13, 15, and 17. Let's read those verses. 13 we just read. Look at verse 15. It says, the heart of the discerning, or the heart of the one that really understands, acquires knowledge. And the ears of the wise seek it out. Now, it's not just listening, but it's an active kind of listening. It's not a passive thing where you're just sitting back and being available, but it's an active kind of listening where you're seeking out in your child's life certain kinds of things. Now, how do you do active listening? Look at verse 17. It says, the first to present his case seems right. You ever been caught in the middle between two people? And each one of them wants you to kind of buy their side of the story? It says here, the first to present his case always seems right till another comes forward and questions him. Coming forward and questioning him. And that's really our third skill here, is questioning our kids in a way that opens the door to their inner purposes. Questioning our kids in a way that opens the door to their inner purposes. Being able to ask a question that allows the child room to kind of bring you down, bring you beneath the waterline down to areas of their life they're struggling with, areas that are hurting them, areas that are leading and controlling them. It really is possible to be able to listen with an active ear. That means ask the kinds of questions that gives the adolescent a chance to talk and take you to what's bothering him, to take you to what's controlling him. Asking the kinds of questions that open the doors for deeper kinds of sharing, the kind of sharing that reveals his inner purposes. Now, we'll come back to that skill as we are to all of these. But look at skill number 4, verse 19. An offended brother is more unyielding than a fortified city, and disputes are like the barred gates of a citadel. When our teenagers strike us as being closed, as we begin to move toward them, to understand them and talk to them, we sense closed doors, bars, anger, layers of resistance. It's a sure sign, according to this verse, that we have an offended brother on our hands. We have someone that's disappointed. Now, there's some verses in Proverbs, other places here, we want to look at a couple, that kind of tip us off to what that's going on. What is it when we run into an offended or disappointed brother? Look at chapter 19, verse 3. It says in 19:3 that a man's own folly ruins his life, yet his heart rages against the Lord. It's funny that our kids, if they follow their strategies of foolishness, they'll ruin their own lives. Their strategy will lead them to bankruptcy, but there'll be a tendency to want to blame others, especially the Lord. But often, more times than not, before the Lord gets the blame, parents even get them. It's a natural thing for an adolescent when he's going through this period of disappointment, he experiences his wrong strategies that worked for him during childhood, no longer effective to face an adult world. It's his first automatic response to blame his parents. And that's oftentimes where we have this disappointed brother. Look at another verse. Look over at chapter 13, verse 12 of Proverbs. Chapter 13, verse 12. It says, "Hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a longing fulfilled is a tree of life." Hope deferred. It's when something we're hoping for, we're counting on, we feel like we need to fill our old emotional tank, when we can't get it, when our hope is put off, when we keep getting postponed, when we can't really grab those things and get the things that we really want for life, the heart grows sick. Now, skill number 4, let me put it this way. It's the ability to trace your child's negative emotions to his disappointed strategies. The ability to trace your child's negative emotions to his disappointed strategies. There's a sense when we run into a person that has barred doors, a person that has shut their doors and really won't let us in, just that anger and resentment is kind of a tip-off to us. It's a key. And we can begin to get some insight into what's going on inside that adolescent by understanding that these kind of negative emotions are always connected to disappointed strategies. And as we come to understand the specific events that these negative emotions are kind of linked to, then it becomes very possible to be able to put that together and say, ah, there's the goal. That's how it's being blocked. Here's my child's wrong strategies. In a minute, we'll come back to that skill too. Finally, in chapter 18, verse 21, the fifth skill is mentioned. And it has to do with the tongue. A very, very important member when it comes to understanding even. Verse 21, it says, "The tongue has the power of life and death, and those who love it will eat its fruit." The tongue has the power of life and death. Talks here about the fact that the tongue is a very powerful medicine. And it has the ability to kill, and it has the ability to give life or build up. And how a person uses it needs to be done just as carefully as the way a person uses a very potent, powerful drug. You know, doctors do a lot of listening. They do a lot of searching for understanding before they prescribe a medicine or a drug. Parents need to be careful the same way. They need to be careful how they use their tongues in applying them to these foolish strategies and how to cut them out and how to use their tongues that way. And tongues are primarily there to be used as instruments of understanding, to reflect understanding that we have in our child and to promote that kind of understanding in him as well. Look at a couple other verses in Proverbs that builds on this idea that the tongue is to be used as a member of life to promote understanding. Look at over chapter 16, verse 21, a few verses there. It says, "The wise in heart are called discerning. And pleasant words promote instruction. Pleasant words promote instruction. It's words of life that promote understanding in your teen. Not only do they help you make sense of your adolescent's behavior, but the parent who has really successfully made some sense of his adolescent's behavior is in turn able to help his adolescent understand his own behavior. Verse 22, understanding is a fountain of life to those who have it, but folly brings punishment to fools. A wise man's heart guides his mouth. Isn't that interesting? A wise man's heart guides his mouth, and his lips promote, again, understanding or instruction. There's a way to use our tongue that helps our kids even see the sense to their own behavior, what's going on underneath. A few other verses, chapter 15. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. It just creates more confusion and chaos. The tongue of the wise commends knowledge, but the mouth of the fool gushes out folly. Again, a good reason why we don't want to be ruled by automatic responses, but we want to reflect and be able to speak out of a heart of understanding. Finally, in verse 4, the tongue that brings healing is a tree of life. But a deceitful tongue, a tongue that seeks to hide the truth, crushes the spirit. The lips of the wise spread knowledge, not so the hearts of fools. Our hearts, we want to be full of understanding. And that's where we want to move now, is we want to talk about these skills that are essential for being able to make sense of our adolescent's behavior and live with them in an understanding way, according to what Peter commanded husbands and household leaders. Now let's look in our notes under the skills area now, the five essential skills. We want to suggest that you'll begin to make sense of your adolescent's behavior when you start to use these five skills in kind of a spontaneous, automatic way. I don't want to build these as stages. First you do skill one, then you do skill two, and on and on. But there are five skills that we need to use in kind of a simultaneous, natural way. And it takes a while. It takes a while for these things to become spontaneous. And we want to take a few minutes today, even after the lecture, and go through some exercises that are going to help us learn how to apply these skills or to put them to work. But let's just try to understand them right now a little bit more. Let's talk about each one of these. First, skill number one, in your notes, point A, discerning your own goals as a parent. I want to suggest to you that that begins by learning to recognize the signs of selfish goals in yourself. There are signals or signs to selfish goals that every parent can begin to recognize in himself. And as he begins to recognize these, then he can begin to redirect them. But you can't redirect something you don't even recognize. And that's the first point we want to make here. Now let me share with you what I have found, at least even in my own life, to be some of those signals. Your signals might be a little bit different, but I would guess they'd be similar. I'd say the number one signal in parents that they're pursuing unselfish or selfish ends or wrong goals is pressure. When they feel a pressure. Now, the pressure could be a pressure to get their kids to behave a certain way, or the pressure to keep things all in harmony around the house here, or a pressure to make sure their kids don't get into a certain kind of trouble. But pressure is more times than not a signal that we're pursuing wrong goals. When we feel the real fear or anxiety that, boy, I'm just not sure I'm going to get my kids to behave. I'm just not sure if I can pull this off. It's almost always a sign that we're pursuing the wrong kind of goals. Goals that are bent on selfishly protecting ourselves. Now, a second goal is resentment, or a second sign. When you sense yourself feeling a wall of anger growing between you and your kids, a kind of a distance. You feel yourself in an angry kind of way, maybe scolding them or disciplining them, or an angry kind of way, even maybe ignoring them. When you sense resentment towards someone, it's almost always a sign that your goal is not correct and it needs to be looked at. A third one is the whole thing of feeling inadequate. When there's a sense of, boy, I'd go in there and I'd correct my kid right now, but I'm not sure I know the right thing to do. Well, I'd ask more questions and get involved in my child's life there, but I'm kind of scared. I think I'm going to let my wife do it. I think I'm going to let my husband do it. When there's a permeating sense of being inadequate for the job, almost always there's some kind of goal involved that I don't want to fail. I don't want to look bad. I don't want to do anything wrong. I don't want to hurt anybody. Because if I hurt anybody, I just couldn't think of myself as a decent person. And underneath that is not love at all, but it's a goal of self-protection. Those are some of the signs of goals that are wrong. And perhaps you need to kind of watch yourself, catch yourself in self-protection or selfish kinds of goals, and learn what they look like. Learn what the signs are for them. Pressure, resentment, a sense of inadequacy that paralyzes you, those kinds of things. And as you begin to recognize the fact that, whoops, wait a minute, I'm being controlled by a selfish goal right now. I could go upstairs and blow my kid away for this. There's just something about me that wants to grab him and put him up against the wall. Now, wait a minute. There's something wrong about that goal. Our second step would be to acknowledge these to God and reflect on the unbelief that's behind the goal. Every wrong goal is connected somewhere in our life to unbelief. A lack of trusting in God to protect us, and so a desire now to protect ourselves and relationships. And that's where our goals go wrong. That's where our goals get selfish, is when we begin to believe that, boy, if I don't protect myself in this family, God's not going to. No one's going to. Man, I don't want to fail. I don't want to hurt. I don't want to be embarrassed by my kids. And we come to really believe that our own protection of our own reputation, our protection of our own honor depends on us. And that becomes our goal then. And the first step to getting free of that is acknowledging these goals to God and reflecting on the unbelief behind them. And as we become aware of some of the ugly parts of ourselves that are behind our own goals that often control us in parenting, then we can go to the third step, and that is confessing the wrong goal as you understand it. You'll never have a thorough understanding of it. You never see all of it, but confess it as you understand it to God as sin, and consciously choose a new goal. Lord, I just ask you to forgive me. I just sense so much anger right now toward my kids. And God, I know it's not the kind of anger that accomplishes your righteous purposes for the kids, but I know, Lord, a lot of it has to do with the fact that they just have embarrassed me so bad, and I just feel like crawling in a hole, Lord. I just feel like giving up on them. Father, I just know that'd be wrong right now. I know that would be a goal that would be selfish. And I ask you to forgive me for that. And right now, Lord, I just consciously choose. I'm going to move back toward my kids. I'm going to hang in there. I'm going to keep disciplining them. I'm going to keep responding to them. And Lord, even though my heart is going to break about this news of one of them just getting arrested, Lord, give me the grace to hang in there and keep being a dad to them. That's what I want to do, Lord. And help me be the kind of dad that responds on the basis of what they need, not to just save my own reputation in the community, Lord. That's what I pray. That's the kind of goal redirection that we need. And it requires some reflection, requires some honesty, not denying what's going on in ourselves. That's why we spend so much time early on talking about reflection in parents. Now let's look at a second skill here. Not that we've mastered the first one by any stretch, but we want to look at the second one, and that's listening beneath your children's words. Now that begins with recognizing certain words that carry implicit messages. Recognizing certain words that carry implicit messages. Now, as your kids speak, there are certain words, kind of target words or window words, that you want to start to catch. And those are the words you're going to focus on later with your questions. But you got to catch those words as your child is talking. Somebody said that in a given day, there's about 200,000 or 300,000 words that are said, that are spoken. And that somewhere along the line, as you go through the day and listen to the radio, and as you overhear conversations, and you have quick conversations with people yourself, there's just thousands of words flying by. Now the key is to be able to pick out certain window words that give you insight into messages or things that are going on inside, especially your kids' lives. And you don't have time to do that, to focus on that in a lot of people's lives, but it's absolutely essential that we listen beneath our children's words. We do that by recognizing the words that carry implicit messages. Now, how do we do that? Well, there's a few things that have helped me here. One is words that are laden with emotion, that are colored with emotion. For example, your child might come in and say, I just can't stand that person. Okay? There's some emotional words. And the can't stand just have a lot of meaning and feeling behind it. Maybe anger, maybe hate. Or your child walks in and says, oh, I just love that person. I just love that teacher. Now you hear something underneath that word love, some emotion. Those should just kind of put the parents' little antennas up, and they should say, oh, that's an interesting word. I wonder what he means by love. I wonder what she means by love. I wonder what she means by she can't stand it anymore. I feel desperate. I feel like I want to give up. All those words have emotions attached to them, and those are good words to stop and reflect on and invite your child to talk more about. Now, a second kind of way that we recognize these words are words that are often repeated. I was talking with a teenage girl the other day, and she kept using the word used. I just feel so used. I feel like my mom uses me. I feel like my boyfriend just wants to use me. I just feel used at school. I just feel like, and that word used kept coming up. When there are words that are repeated in our kids' sentences, those are key words that imply that they carry a message that's deep, that there's something implicit. Now, another kind of word are words that are graphic. You know, someone comes in and says, boy, I just feel wrung out. I just feel like somebody just walked all over me. Now, those are graphic words that kind of picture how somebody's feeling deep inside, walked all over, wrung out. Man, I just feel abandoned. What kind of pictures come to your mind when you think of somebody that's wrung out, when somebody that's abandoned? See, most likely those are attached to some pretty deep feelings of pain. Listening beneath words means picking out key words for implicit messages. Now, you know the difference between an implicit message and an explicit message. An explicit message are the words that are the most obvious meaning. It's the message that's carried by the words themselves. Implicit messages are words that are not... it's the meaning of the words. It's only kind of hidden or implied. They're not real clearly expressed. Now, if you're not careful, you can go nuts on this. You can start to think in terms that there's an implicit message to everything and can become kind of a psychological vulture. You don't want to do that with your kids. Your kid walks in and says, Mom, what's to eat? You don't want to stop and say, what do you really mean? What do you really mean? You know, not all words have implicit messages. That sounds like to me a simple sentence. A kid is hungry and wants something to eat. Many of your kids' sentences will just be straight, explicit messages. But many will also have implied messages in which your child's hoping that somebody might pick up on and care enough to ask. Care enough to ask more. Now, a second part of this, of listening beneath your words, is reflecting then on the impact that certain words have on you. Your child comes home and says something like this, I've got to go out tonight. Before I go out, though, I've got to call Matt. I've got to call Matt and let him know what I'm doing tonight. Now, you hear your teenage girl saying that about her teenage boyfriend, that she's got to call and let Matt know. And you have some kind of uncomfortable feeling about that. You just feel kind of uncomfortable about it, and you wonder what's going on. Whenever certain words in your kid's vocabulary or certain phrases they say make you feel uncomfortable, then stop a minute and reflect and just ask yourself, I wonder why that I'm so uncomfortable with that. I guess it's because it sounds like they're almost married. I guess it sounds like that maybe Matt thinks he owns my daughter. I guess it bothers me because I'm not sure I want my daughter in that kind of relationship. Now, unless I stop and reflect on the impact that those words had on me, I might have missed a whole lot of important data. I might have missed a whole lot of important things that could be going on in my girl's life. When you hear the sentence where it says, I feel sick, but I've got to go to practice. I can't let coach down. When you hear your son say that, and there's something inside you that goes, boy, that doesn't sound right, stop a minute and reflect on it. Why does that impact you so bad? Well, I guess it's because it sounds like my son's holding the coach up. It almost sounds like the coach is using the boys on his team to get his own emotional needs met. And I'm not sure I want my son feeling responsible, keeping some 35-year-old man's ego boosted up. That kind of bothers me, and I think I need to talk to my son about that. Do you see, when certain sentences impact you in a certain way, go with them. Think about it and think it through. Why is it that certain words bother me? Finally, in listening beneath your child's words, you want to develop a genuine curiosity about the meaning your children attach to their words. You want to kind of get curious or intrigued with your kid's words. And when your kid uses a word that you're not quite sure what it means, it's time to stop and get kind of curious about it. I wonder what my kid said when he asked me, "What do you do about people that say bad words?" I wonder what he meant about bad words. I wonder what my kid meant when he says he just wishes somebody would trust him. Huh. I wonder what that means. We need to develop a real curiosity. If we're going to be good students of our students, we need to be real curious about their words. Listening beneath words. Now, after we've listened, we've got to be good at questioning, because the listening beneath words tips us off to what questions to ask. And that introduces our third skill here, questioning in a way that opens doors to your child's inner purposes. Questioning in a way that opens doors to your child's inner purposes. Now, the first thing here in developing this skill is to learn to ask questions that encourage further sharing of what might be implied by your children's words. That's just a natural extension of the second skill of listening beneath your children's words. Learn to ask questions that encourages further sharing on what your child might be implying by his words. So your child says, I can't believe no one ever trusts me. And a good question would be one that says, what do you mean no one trusts you? Tell me more about what that is. What's it like not to be trusted? That would encourage further sharing. Now, notice there, the second part, though, is to use questions that encourage your child to reflect out loud without fear of reprisal. Now, there's a way I could have asked that question that would have implied that my child needed a fear of reprisal. Like, I could have said, "What do you mean nobody trusts you?" I wonder what my kid said when he asked me, "What do you do about people that say bad words?" I wonder what he meant about bad words. I wonder what my kid meant when he says he just wishes somebody would trust him. Huh. I wonder what that means. We need to develop a real curiosity. If we're going to be good students of our students, we need to be real curious about their words. Listening beneath words. Now, after we've listened, we've got to be good at questioning, because the listening beneath words tips us off to what questions to ask. And that introduces our third skill here, questioning in a way that opens doors to your child's inner purposes. Questioning in a way that opens doors to your child's inner purposes. Now, the first thing here in developing this skill is to learn to ask questions that encourage further sharing of what might be implied by your children's words. That's just a natural extension of the second skill of listening beneath your children's words. Learn to ask questions that encourages further sharing on what your child might be implying by his words. So your child says, I can't believe no one ever trusts me. And a good question would be one that says, what do you mean no one trusts you? Tell me more about what that is. What's it like not to be trusted? That would encourage further sharing. Now, notice there, the second part, though, is to use questions that encourage your child to reflect out loud without fear of reprisal. Now, there's a way I could have asked that question that would have implied that my child needed a fear of reprisal. Like, I could have said, "What do you mean nobody trusts you?" Now, no kid being asked that question is going to feel very open to explore his inner purposes with me or the things that are going on inside. So I got to be careful that when I ask my questions, it's in a mood of collaboration, in a mood of wanting to create kind of a curious moment between the two of us, a moment in which we can reflect together. So I want to use questions that encourage my child to reflect out loud without the fear of reprisal. Now that's like gold. That's like gold when you get your child to reflect out loud with you. There's probably no other quicker way to get to his heart and to see what's inside than to get them to reflect out loud. Timing is important here. Oftentimes it's going to take some time. Oftentimes it's around bedtimes when you go in and sit on the edge of your kid's bed, or it's going from one place to another. It's moments when your child doesn't feel on edge, when he doesn't feel defensive, that he's most likely going to reflect out loud with you. That's why sometimes, as you're listening underneath words, it's not a good time to pick up on a word immediately. Sometimes you take that word, I wonder what my kid means by used, and put that in the filing cabinet of your head. And the next time you're with him in a non-defensive moment, say, hey, you know, the other day, son, you were talking about feeling used. Tell me some more about that. Tell me some more about that. I'm asking a question that encourages sharing without making him defensive, without saying, now be careful how you answer this, son, because if you put me down or attack me in the way you answer this, I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you back. I want to be careful. And let me suggest here that questions that begin with why usually aren't good questions. Why did you say that? Why did you do that? It's so easy for why questions to put kids on the defensive and make them feel interrogated. What questions are so much better? What did you have in mind when you said that, son? What kinds of things are involved in that, son? I wonder what goes on in your head when this happens. I wonder what exactly you were thinking when you decided to run that stoplight, son. Sometimes that's even good when they're even in the midst of outright defiance, because it gives the kids a chance to talk about their anger. It gives them a chance to get it out. Finally, you want to avoid cross-examining your child with questions that can be answered in one or two words. Avoid cross-examining your child with questions that can be answered in one or two words. Now, there's something we call a high-structured question versus a low-structured question. And we as parents are awfully good at high-structured questions, and we need to learn to develop the skill of low-structured questions. Now, a high-structured question is a question which is often heard by Howard Cosell when he's doing interviews. He'll stop by a football or see a football player and says, hey, tonight, when you're out in the field, and just as you caught that pass and as you ran down there and you thought you were going to get all the way and the guy tackled you and you just fell into the end zone and you got the touchdown unexpected, wasn't that just a fabulous time in your life? And the guy can't answer anything but, yeah. The question is so structured that all you can do is answer it with one or two words. Now, son, the other day I overheard you talking on the telephone to your friend. And you said to your friend something about Friday night. Now, were you thinking that I was going to let you go out Friday night? See, do you see how high structured that is? That's just a yes or no question. And so often we ask our kids just questions that can be answered like, son, how was school today? Fine. What'd you learn today? Not much. You see, so many of those questions sound like interrogation questions, can be answered in one or two words. We want to try to ask questions that get the child to explore more and talk. Like, I wonder, son, what was going on in your mind when this happened? Talk more about this, son. Help me understand when you say this, what you mean. Those kinds of questions are just going to get the child talking so he'll eventually snare his own soul. He'll eventually take you right to the heart of the matter. Now, the fourth skill here is tracing your child's negative emotions to disappointed strategies. Tracing your child's negative emotions to disappointed strategies. As your child is talking, and as you're asking questions, you're going to start seeing negative emotions. And we want to talk in terms of three basic families of negative emotions. Three basic families. There's the one family that's all revolves around the same basic feeling of anger. Resentment, frustration, aggravation, irritation. All those emotions are kind of related to the emotion of anger. Now, anger is a signal of a certain kind of goal in your child. Anger is always linked to a blocked goal. Whenever one of your child's wrong strategies is blocked, there'll be an emotion in that family: anger, irritation, frustration, resentment, hate, something like that. Now, a second family of emotions is related to the idea of fear. There's worry, there's anxiety, there's maybe the sense of being terrified. All those ideas relate around this one family of fear. Now, fear is almost always a sign that there's a goal your child has, a strategy he has, he's not certain he can pull off. It's an uncertain goal. He's uncertain whether he can accomplish it. He feels so scared before the tryouts at school because he's just afraid he won't make the tryouts. And his strategy is to be in the spotlight at school, to be on top, to be achieving. And he's scared to death if he fails and he doesn't stay on the top, that he won't be regarded highly, he won't be loved. You see, so the fear tips us off to a wrong strategy of being accepted and loved by always achieving at school. There's a third family of emotions, and that's the family of emotions that relates around guilt. Sometimes it's shame. Sometimes people talk in terms of being embarrassed. Embarrassment, shame, guilt, sense of inadequacy, all those are kind of related to this whole idea of guilt. And that's a sign of a goal that you feel like you haven't reached, an unreached goal. And you feel like, man, everybody was expecting me to deliver. Everybody was expecting me to be there, and I wasn't there. And there's a sense of shame because I didn't live up to what my strategy says I have to live up to be able to hold my head up high, to be respected as a person. And so guilt is a sign of an unreached goal. So as we listen to our kids and their emotions, and if we hear anger, we know, hey, there's a block strategy here, a block goal. If we hear fear, there's an uncertain goal. My kid's afraid he's not going to be able to pull it off. If it's an unreached goal, my kid is ashamed and guilty because there's something he thinks he needs for life he hasn't been able to accomplish. And maybe it's the fact that the kid really feels like, you know, a real good Christian kid just never loses his temper. A real good Christian always reads his Bible. A good Christian kid doesn't struggle with lust. And so your son struggles with all those things, and so he feels guilty. He feels like, man, how can anybody respect me? How can God ever use me? It's a wrong strategy. The strategy is God will use me if I'm good enough. And that's really an unbiblical strategy. As we learn to identify signal emotions in our child, we can ask our child to connect his feelings to specific events. Your child comes home and he's just sitting there kind of down. And you go over and say, what's wrong, son? He says, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm just feeling kind of out of it. Well, now, out of it is a word you need to listen to. Because underneath that word, there's a lot of meaning. So with your listening underneath word skill, now you move to asking a question. Well, son, talk about what you mean by out of it. I'm not sure I know what that means. Okay, there's your question. Here's your question that opens the door to further sharing. So your son says, oh, I don't know. I just feel like I can't do anything right. Okay, as a parent now, you're starting to think, ah, there's a signal emotion. There's an emotion that sounds an awful lot like guilt. He can't do anything right. It sounds to me like he's got some strategy, wrong strategy, he hasn't been able to live up to, and he feels like a failure. He feels guilty. So that leads me now to ask him to connect that to a certain event. Connect that emotion to a certain event. So I'm going to say, son, this feeling you have of just not feeling like you're good for anything or can really accomplish anything, what kinds of things are going on to make you feel that way? What kinds of things are going on that make you feel that way? Now I'm looking for specific events. Now my son then describes the fact that he was hoping that a certain girl would go out with him, but he wasn't able to get this girl to go out with him on a date, and it was something else he was trying to accomplish with another friend, and that didn't work. And it turned out that now he has nothing to do this weekend, and now he just feels worthless, like nobody wants to spend any time with him. Does that give you an idea? Does it give you any picture into what a wrong strategy might be? Do you think possibly the kid might have the strategy that life depends on having people around me? Life depends on having people like me? Life depends on feeling like I'm part of the party and being active and being with people? And now, how have I gotten to that? How have I gotten inside that kid's inner purposes? Well, I've done it by listening underneath words. I've done it by asking questions. I've done it by tracing his negative emotions to wrong strategies. And now I know how to respond to my kid. Now I can apply this medicine. I can use my tongue, but it's on the basis of understanding I have some idea of what's going on in my son's life. Finally, as I ask him, I want to develop hunches as to the content of his disappointed strategies. Develop hunches. And no hunch is going to be 100% perfect. But if I can just get in the ballpark with my hunches, and I think I'm in the ballpark with this boy I'm talking about his strategy. And if I'm just in the ballpark, then when I respond, it's going to be an appropriate response. It's going to be an accurate response if I'm even just in the ballpark with my hunch about what's going on. Chuck shared last week at the beginning of our lecture how he developed a hunch about one of his sons. And based on that hunch, he and his wife decided how they were going to respond to his kid. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for a parent who responds to his kid on the basis of understanding. Not on the basis of fear, not on the basis of impulse, but on the basis of understanding, developing a hunch. And you can't develop a hunch about what's going on inside your kid until you use these skills of listening underneath words, questioning the child in a way that exposes his deeper purposes, and then tracing the negative emotions to wrong strategies. Now, the final skill that we just want to mention here is the skill of speaking life words that promote understanding in your child instead of confusion and despair. Speaking life words that promote understanding in your child instead of confusion and despair. Life words, words that promote life. And they have three characteristics that I haven't mentioned here in your notes. Let's look at those. First of all, notice that life words shed light on your child's inner purposes without communicating rejection. Life words communicate respect, not rejection, while they shed light on your child's inner purposes. Now, it's interesting. It's not life words for your doctor to come in the office and you have cancer, and he's not going to come in and say, well, you got cancer. Just not sure there's much we can do for you. That's not life words. That's kind of a feeling of, well, come on, doc. Come up with a solution. And it's not necessarily life words when he comes in and says to himself, I really wish I could share with these folks about what's going on with them, but I don't think they can handle it. I think I'm going to have to hide the fact from them. That's not life words. That's death words. If I don't know what I'm dying of, if I don't know what I've got, I'm just going to continue to follow that course that's going to lead me down the broad path. So life words are words that speak the truth, but they speak him in love. They speak the truth, but they speak them in such a way they don't communicate rejection. They say, hey, listen, I've got bad news for you. You got cancer, but the good news is there's a lot we can do about it. I'm sticking with you. And they communicate respect and presence of staying involved. That's life words. Life words, secondly, help your child make sense of his own behavior. They promote understanding, not confusion. So often a parent gets upset at his child and he asks questions that promotes confusion. It doesn't promote understanding in the child. He'll say, I don't understand why you do that. Just tell me why you do that. And it leaves the child even more confused, thinking that, well, I don't know why I do it. Dad, forgive me, I'm sorry, I won't ever do it again. Well, that's what you said last time. Why can't I trust you? Huh? Why can't I trust you? And those kinds of questions just promote confusion. They're death words. There are words that say, son, you're untrustworthy. Son, I give up on you. Son, I don't understand you. Son, you're a lost cause. Son, you just make me sick. And those are all death words. They're not life words that say, son, I think I got an idea of why it's so hard for you to keep your word. It's really been disappointing to me lately, son, the way that you say you'll take the garbage out, you say you'll do your homework, you say you'll have the car in by a certain time, but you don't. But I think I got an idea why you're having such a trouble with it. Let's sit down and talk about it. Oh, those are life words. Yeah, son, you got cancer, but let's sit down because I think I understand what the cure is. I think I got a cure for it. Those are life words for our kids. Finally, life words are prompted out of a genuine understanding and respect of the person, and they offer far more encouragement than just advice. Life words are prompted out of a genuine understanding and respect of the person, respect for our children, and they offer far more than just advice. Remember, we read that verse in the beginning from Proverbs. It says, a wise man's heart guides his mouth. And life words are prompted out of an understanding of the child, an understanding of who he is and what kinds of things are going on inside. It really is possible to make sense of our child's behavior and then help him make sense of his own behavior by communicating life words, words that are spoken out of understanding. It's interesting. In Ephesians 4, Paul says, don't let any zero talk come out of your mouth. Don't let any unwholesome words or zero talk. But only the word that is needful for the moment, or only the word that is good for the moment for building up someone else. Our words need to be words of life that are spoken carefully out of understanding for the purpose of building our kids up, of bringing healing, of ministering to them. Life words are prompted then out of that genuine understanding. Speaking words of life, words that are truthful, they give the kids insight in themselves, but they're words also that communicate, son, in the midst of what you're going through, I think I got an idea of how to help. I think I got an idea of where the problem's coming from. And I'm here with you. I'm involved with you. I'm going to help you find a solution. That's life words. Words of life. Five essential skills, and we're going to spend some time now doing some short exercises, learning about how to discern your own goals as a parent, how to listen beneath your children's words, how to question in a way that opens doors to your child's inner purposes, how to trace your child's negative emotions to disappointing strategies, and finally, how to speak life words that promote understanding in your child. Five essential skills.